Namibia has been my life, part of my life. Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe for the last 12 years. For the last 15 years. For 12 of those years, I've paid for it, and for the last three since retirement, I've been doing almost the same thing free. So, yeah, this is the life. I put up there a lot of dates, which I don't expect you to remember, but I want you to show you that for 100 years, over 100 years, this land has suffered under oppression. That is, the black inhabitants of that land have suffered under oppression. And I gave this the title of Namibia in the Crossfire. And it's literally, people of Namibia are literally in the crossfire today. I'll give an example of a bishop, Bishop James Kaluma, the bishop of the Anglican Church. Last month, August 24th, went to a school where the South African Army had moved in order to arrest students who were boycotting classes in sympathy with other students in the North who were boycotting classes. And the reason they were boycotting classes in the North was because the Army had put installations practically next door to every high school. And they would be bringing soldiers in to monitor classes and things like that. And the students said, "We can't study with these people on our back." And so they were boycotting classes. This bishop had just come home from the Lambeth Conference, which is the most important conference of the Anglican Church. Came home from England and found that in a community of his area, students were boycotting classes and the army tanks and police had moved in. So he went to the place and was cordoned off by saying, "You cannot enter," by fences. So obedient, stood on the outside, saw some students start to be arrested and thrown violently into vans, and then the army started shooting rubber bullets. And the bishop turned and started to go through a hole in the fence to escape all of this wild shooting, and was shot with rubber bullets twice, once in the back and once in the leg. Now you talk about rubber bullets, they're not soft rubber. They inflict great pain and bruises, yes.
I'd like to support that. I have held them in my hand and they are hard as rock.
Yeah.
And they are about that long and about that big around. And I suppose they weigh anywhere from 6 to 10 ounces each.
Yeah.
And when they are propelled with the force that they are, with gunpowder or explosive charge behind them, they can kill if they hit in the right place.
He was badly bruised, taken to the hospital. Students were taken to the hospital. Wasn't the first time that he was shot at. He, with the Lutheran bishop up north, were at a home praying with a widow of a man who had just been killed. And the police moved in there. And they ordered them to come out. They didn't know who they were. They came out and one shot carelessly, real bullets, but missed. And then they saw their cleric of garb and started to apologize. So the life of a minister is more important than the life of anyone else. So they are literally in a crossfire, even bishops. Those are church leaders, church workers, pastors, teachers, medical workers are killed and imprisoned in Namibia. Lay people, professional lay people, I mean people who own stores, business people, there aren't very many professionals as we think of them, lawyers, doctors, couple of doctors, but not very many, I mean, of black people, they too are killed and imprisoned, and houses are burned down, deliberately destroyed. They come in to search a house, and they have flashlights, but they use torches and accidentally set houses on fire. That is the way it is presented in court when they are charged with that kind of crime and arson. And politically, they've been in the crossfire for 100 years. Now I put some dates up on the board just so that I will discipline myself and talk about only the most important things. And I'm going to speak rather rapidly because we want to get down to 1988 and 89. But I want to tell you what happened, what important things happened, to give some people some hope, and then it was dashed again very often as far as those dates are concerned. Some of the dates, however, were not giving the people much hope. The first one, 1884, is the date of the so-called Berlin Conference. This was called by Bismarck. He called the nations of Europe together, those who were colonizing Africa. Bismarck was afraid that Germany would not get its share. And so they were there, the French, the British, the Germans, the Belgians, and others who, Portuguese, those who had colonies in Africa. And they carved up Africa. And the Germans were assigned here and there, Tanzania, for instance, that they are known as Tanganyika. And they received this area down here, which was known as Southwest Africa, German Southwest Africa. That was assigned to Germany. Right north of that was Portuguese. South and South Africa, there were Dutch and British. And in Kenya, the British had those. And the Belgian Congo, some of them carried those names. Algeria went to the French, and so forth and so on. The only people who weren't present were the Africans. It was the Germans and the French and the Belgians who were dividing up Africa. And they assigned certain territories, and they assigned the geographical areas in which they were to work. And they would divide some tribes who were not only friendly, but of one family, real tribes, and they would unite other tribes who were at war with each other in various parts of Africa. So the boundaries didn't mean anything. That happened once in Namibia as well. This northern border of Namibia also has people of the Ovambo tribe over in Angola. And so they were cut across by a river which did not divide the tribe because they settled on both sides, but now they were legally divided. That happened in 1884. And what happened? Well, the merchants move in, the settlers move in, the armies move in, the missionaries move in, and take over the land. Yesterday, a man was sitting in this chair, or another chair, but in this place, who talked about genocide. In Namibia, between 1904 and 1908, two tribes, the Namas and the Hereros, which numbered about 120,000, were reduced to 40,000. They were killed, their cattle stolen, their land inhabited by settlers. So that was the first great kind of massacre that took place among those people. The missionaries at that time, in this blue sheet here, I wrote that, is an unromantic portrayal of how the mission work was carried on in the very early days. Maybe we would have done the same. But that was an era in which we had to repent. I don't know that formal repentance was ever carried out. But even amid all of that slaughter and the affirmation of that slaughter by the missionaries, the word of God came through, and Namibia is one of the most Christian countries in the world. Probably 90% of the people in Namibia are Christians. Convicted Christians, Christians with conviction. They are baptized and confirmed. The Lutheran church is the strongest. Finns came to the north and missionized the church there. They were God's mission agents, because the Germans didn't have enough missionaries, and so they called the Finns to come. The Finns were not colonizers. And the Finns had the good sense to know that the Finnish language was never going to be an international language, and they taught in their schools English. And for a while that was all right, but the South Africans in our generation wanted them to change and teach Afrikaans. That was in 1976. That's what caused the Soweto uprising in South Africa. And the students in Namibia did the same, although they didn't have that publicity. But let us hurry on. 1915, South African army invaded Namibia and set up military rule. Why? Because it was a German colony, and Germans and the British in South Africa especially were at war. So that was a world war in which South Africa went into Namibia and claimed the territory, defeated the people, threw the Germans in prison, etc., etc. The South Africans at that time had a divided country. There were Afrikaans people, people of Dutch descent, who were, and of German, some of German descent, who were in favor of Hitler. And they were thrown into prison. One of them later became Prime Minister. Prime Minister Foster, V-O-R-S-T-E-R, pronounced Foster. He was at the time of apartheid, many of these former Nazis came into power. Neither President Reagan didn't know history, or his speechwriters didn't know history, or they wanted to ignore history, where they put in one of his earlier speeches that the South Africans have always been and still are allies of the United States. But the people who were in power in 1981 were in prison during World War II. So that's 1915. Troops occupied Southwest Africa. And in 1920 then, under the League of Nations, a mandate was given to Britain to bring Namibia to independence. At that time, there was the Union of South Africa. The British and the Dutch in immigrants ruled South Africa together, a union of South Africa. And so this British mandate was given to South Africa, where there were also British people, to implement in Namibia. But they didn't. They didn't bring it to independence. Instead, they exploited the land. You must say something about the land. That little orange land over there is as big as California and Nevada together. The coastline is longer than the California coastline. It has a small population, somewhere I suppose around 1,200,000. Nobody really knows the population. It may go up to 2 million even, but most people think it's somewhere around 1,200,000. About 10% are white. The others are black. And it's a rich country, mineral-wise. It has diamonds along the southern coast. If you're wearing a diamond ring, chances are 50-50 that it came from this part of Africa, because that's where the gem diamonds are. Angola has industrial diamonds, and other countries, Belgian Congo, which is now Zaire, they also have industrial diamonds, but the gem diamonds come from that area, and they come from Russia. And they have copper. We heard something about copper if you took the mine hike, and now the price has gone down. Well, that those mines are pretty well milked by this time, too. It has lead. It has good farmland in certain areas. All these mines and all of the good areas of farmland are owned by the whites, and the blacks are put into homelands in various parts of the less fertile soil and where there are no mines. And it has uranium. Sixth largest supply of uranium mines in the world. So that's Namibia, wealthy country. All of the wealth goes out of the country into transnational corporations, mostly South African corporations. There's only one port, one deep water port on that whole coast. It's known as Walvis Bay, which means walrus. Walrus Bay. There are a lot of fishing industry that goes along that coast as well, a number of islands that are also claimed by Southwest Africa. So that's the physical territory. Now, in 1966, after the United Nations came into being, and it is not a legal successor of the League of Nations, it's a new organization. But wherever there were mandates of this kind left over from World War II, they were given to the United Nations, and no nation in the world objected. They all said the mandate can now be supervised by the United Nations, except in the case of Namibia, where South Africa said it would not render any reports to the United Nations, even though it was a member of the United Nations, and had agreed at the time of the charter to do the things that the Security Council called upon it to do. It refused to do it. Well, the United Nations wasn't ready to march in with an army, and that's the only way you could do it, or have economic sanctions at that time, or any kind of penalty. So South Africa resisted, and the world community allowed that kind of resistance. But in 1966, the General Assembly revoked the mandate from South Africa and said, we will take care of the supervision of Namibia ourselves. Never has been able to do it because South Africa has an army and the United Nations does not. In 1967, still in 1966, right after, a month after, the mandate of South Africa was revoked, the group inside the of Namibia, which had been trying to get independence by many peaceful means for more than 20 years. Strikes, boycotts, you know, the kinds of peaceful things that people do to protest. They decided that that wasn't going to work and took up arms. Went into Zambia, which was by that time was free, in order to try to fight from Zambia. And it was a losing battle, a low-scale war. South Africa's army is so strong, but all they could do is sabotage a few things and attack military bases, like the African National Congress. They wanted to just attack military things, military targets, and some economic targets, but they did not want the general population to suffer because of the armed struggle. 1967, then, the United Nations established the Council for Namibia, and the Commissioner's Office was also established at that time. Commissioner for Namibia was to be the legal representative of the Namibian people, accepted by most nations of the world, but not by South Africa and some of the Western countries. Struggled along, and South Africa would keep saying things like, well, the Security Council's revoking our mandate doesn't mean anything as far as we're concerned, and we don't recognize the United Nations as the legal successor to the League of Nations. But in 1971, the International Court of Justice at The Hague handed down its opinion. And its opinion was that the South Africa is illegally occupying Namibia and is under obligation to withdraw. Withdraw its administration, withdraw its army, withdraw its police, get out of Namibia. That was the opinion of the International Court of Justice. That opinion was accepted then by the Security Council of the United Nations, to which South Africa had said, when it joined the United Nations, had signed that it would obey the resolutions of the Security Council. That Security Council was passed without negative vote. There were a few who abstained, the United Kingdom being one of them, but and France being one, but no one vetoed it. So it was an opinion, a majority opinion, but South Africa did not abide by it. When that was passed, there was great rejoicing. This was another time, not only in 1915, when there was a mandate given to bring independence to Namibia, but 1971 especially. There was great rejoicing because they said, now the World Court has passed this. But not many people knew that. The radios did not report it. The radios were all controlled by South Africa. But the word did come to the churches. And a bishop up north of the Lutheran Church, Bishop Leonard Awala, had a paper which was read in the churches every Sunday. People can't subscribe to a newspaper over there, but they did have a means of communication. And so they spoke about this in their newspaper and said that now Namibia was going to be free. And the South Africans called upon the bishop to renounce what he had said and also to denounce the United Nations and the International Court of Justice. And then the bishop published an open letter in which he deplored apartheid, in which he criticized the South African army and the South African government, told them to get out of the country, said that they did not want in their country these homelands, this homeland policy, because it divided people, that they didn't want a contract system with labor where they had to sign up for a year at a time and go away from their homes, because that broke up families. He said all of those things, and the people were not literally up in arms, but the people were getting restless and they were criticizing the South African government. Yes.
Was this bishop black or white?
Black.
Black.
Mm-hmm. Black bishop. The whole church was behind him. In 1973, because this newspaper was causing so much trouble, the whole printing press was blown up. And the South African government said it was SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, that did it. That's the Liberation Army. And the bishop said, we don't know that we have any enemies in SWAPO. Many of those people are members of our church, maybe more than half. We don't know what motive they would have to destroy our printing press. And so they said they would hold an investigation, and the investigation came out that unknown arsonists had bombed the printing press. Well, it was rebuilt by the Lutheran World Federation. It was destroyed again in 1980 by another bomb with the same kind of investigation that it was destroyed by unknown arsonists. A South African came to Bishop Awala and said, you know, your press would be safe if you would just print news of the churches. And by that he meant who was baptized, who was confirmed, who was married, what meetings were going to be held, and so forth. You should just print things that the church should be concerned about. And Bishop Awala's answer was, God is the creator of the world. Everything in the world is under the control of God. We only print church language, church news. But that did not save the printing presses. And so we're down to 1971. 1974 was a historic year because at that time, the commissioner of Namibia, a new commissioner of Namibia, was appointed. The first one was out of the Middle East, one of the Middle East countries, and he didn't do very much. But they elected to that position a man by the name of Sean McBride. Sean McBride was a co-founder of Amnesty International. He was a founder of the International Commission for Jurists. He was the chief staff member of the International Commission for Jurists for a time. An Irish international lawyer and an Irish diplomat. That's who he was. Won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1975, I believe it was. Sean McBride made three big contributions. One was that he started in Lusaka, Zambia, a school known as the Namibia Institute, in which they found the most promising young refugees and started to train them for civil service so that when Namibia would be free, there would be a group of people who would be able to start filling positions in government. A great thought, a great idea, the first time that that had ever done in the history of the world. And the president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, appraised him for that. In the second place, he got passed something called Decree Number 1. Obviously, he had hoped for more decrees, but Decree Number 1 was to protect all of this mineral wealth of Namibia. And it said the rightful owners are the Namibian people, the rightful administrator is the United Nations, and anyone who takes anything out of Namibia should first get permission from the United Nations. Now, of course, South Africa was up in arms about that. It was passed by the General Assembly, never passed by the Security Council. A couple of nations took it into their law. One of them was Holland, the Netherlands. And right now there is a trial going on in the Netherlands because the Netherlands has imported some of this uranium without the permission of the United Nations. Now it's a very complicated case and I can't go into that, but that was another thing that Sean McBride did. And the third thing that he did that was very important was to get the Southwest African People's Organization recognized and funded by the United Nations as far as their diplomatic service was concerned. so that they have an office in New York, which is paid for largely by the Council for Namibia. Their staff people are paid for by the Council for Namibia and the like. Before that, these people would have to come around hat in hand. And we helped them out. Once their representative, the United Nations, couldn't pay his rent. We paid it out of our office, $400 a month or something like that, for a couple of months. And but he got them recognition in that way. And he saw to it that a resolution 368 of the Security Council was passed. It was a plan to bring Namibia into independence. Now those things happened under Sean McBride, 1974 through 1976. In that era, the United States was having some problems. You remember that was the Nixon-Ford time. And Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State. Henry Kissinger hated Sean McBride. He saw to it that he did not get reelected when his term was up. And it was a great loss. McBride died this year? Mm-hmm. Earlier this year?
Last year.
Mm-hmm. He died recently. We became very good friends. Fine person. He was a Catholic from Ireland. You'd expect him to be a Catholic. He was on the Pope's Commission for Justice and Peace. He was also a religious man, not only a great politician. Up until this time, the United States had kind of a hands-off policy as far as Namibia was concerned. If some of you remember Kissinger's Tar Baby Report, that said essentially that the whites are in South Africa and Namibia to stay, that progress can only be made through them. You shouldn't pay any attention to black people. Just work through the whites. That was Kissinger's point of view, and I suppose still is. But it was during this time also, and we're going to talk about that more really down in 1988 because we have to reflect back. It was at this time that the United States became involved in Angola through the CIA, giving arms and other kinds of supplies to an organization known as UNITA, which is a revolutionary organization trying to overthrow the government in Angola, and that's been going on since that time. But we'll talk about that. But now I put up 1975, I can't remember why I have that up there. 1977, was the beginning of the Carter administration. Andrew Young became the delegate or the ambassador from the United States to the United Nations. His assistant, Donald McHenry. Donald McHenry was given the assignment, supported by Andrew Young, and he was given the assignment to do something about Namibia. First time in the history of the United States that we officially took some action trying to do something to free these people. What McHenry did was to say, the United Nations system is too cumbersome. We will form a group outside of the United Nations of people in the United Nations who are influential and who are also influential in South Africa and see if we can come to some agreement. And so he pulled together a group which was known as the Western Five, the contact group. That was the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, three permanent members of the Security Council, and two others who were on the Security Council at that time, but temporarily. They're elected every 2 years. There's a rotation for 10 of the members. That was Canada and the Federal Republic of Germany. And they formulated a plan, which then was presented early in 1978. I have a whole list of dates there in 1978. They proposed a way in which Namibia could become free. And it became known in all circles of people who talk about Namibia as United Nations Security Council Resolution 435. 435 says essentially that all the exiles can return home without penalty. That SWAPO's military wing lay down its arms in the country where they are, whether it's Zambia or Angola. Most of the time now they're in Angola. And that they can come back in order to take part in the process of elections. All political prisoners should be freed. And that a United Nations group consisting of several thousand people, about 5,000 people, 1,000 of them being civilians and 4,000 being a United Nations military wing, come into Namibia in order to allow a political process to take place by which an assembly would be elected which would write the constitution. So there was to be a 6-month period of time in which electioneering would be done. Because there were many small political parties in Namibia. They didn't want to be left out of the picture. And this got support from everybody, and it was passed unanimously by the Security Council on September 28th, 1988. I mean 1978. We're going to see what the process was in working up to that. South Africa agreed to that proposal by the Western Five on April 25th. I have a 425 up there. April 25th, 1978. And as soon as South Africa had agreed to that, it became obvious that there was a division in South Africa between the army, the military, and the political powers which had agreed to it. SWAPO was the other party that had to agree, because that was the other one who was fighting. And they had come to this meeting without all of their executive committee. And they said, we have to go home and into Luanda and have a meeting of our executive committee and we'll be back. So there was a 10-day period in there from April 25th to May 4th. What happened on May 4th besides that my wife was born on that day? It happened to be Ascension Day that year. On May 4th, the South African Army entered Angola, raided a refugee camp, killed over 700 people, most of them women, children, and old men who had fled from Namibia. The only military that were in that camp were a few guards, somewhere around 20 guards for 1,000 peoples. Some were not killed. They were carried off to prison and put in prison in Namibia for a number of years. That's what happened on May 4th. Why did that happen? because the military disagreed with the political powers in South Africa, and they had hoped that this action would cause the Southwest African People's Organization to say, we do not agree to that plan. And if they would say, we do not agree to the plan, then the whole onus, the burden would be put on the Southwest African People's Organization for refusing, rather than on South African government. But they surprised the South African government and many in the world community. On July 12th, they agreed. They said, we will abide by that plan. We will go into all the things that Resolution 435 says. We'll lay down our arms. We will call for a ceasefire. We will participate in the political process peacefully. And if others win the election, that's up to them. We will participate. So they surprised everyone by giving that kind of an answer. Then on the 20th of September, South Africa had second thoughts and said that as far as that United Nations Resolution 435 was concerned, that they wanted to say that they had some questions about it now, but that they are not in full agreement with it. But in spite of that, on September 28th, 1978, the Security Council passed it unanimously, and called on South Africa to get out, call for a ceasefire, and to move toward the implementation of that resolution. That'll be 10 years ago next Thursday. Now I must rush on. I want to say I've moved down now to 1981 in January. There was a pre-implementation meeting in Geneva in order to carry out this plan. But South Africa has to agree to that. And now it is making new demands that it hasn't made before. So there are a lot of us who feel that Namibia is going to still be in bondage. It's in this terrible situation. If South Africa does agree, then the peacekeeping force of the United Nations, these 5,000 troops, and the 1,000 civilians will start to be assembled and will be sent into Namibia sometime in early December. And by June or July 1st, the Constituent Assembly will have been elected and will start to meet, and Namibia will have independence. So that's where we are. It's one of those situations. Nobody knows how it's going to, well, maybe somebody knows how it's going to come out. I don't know how it's going to come out. There are a couple of things that give me hope. One is that the Republican Party needs a victory in foreign policy, which it does not have. This was the promise by Chester Crocker and the president that Namibia would be free during his administration. So they really need that foreign policy victory. That's one the United States has to do by itself. Another one is that Russia has been meeting with this group in an informal capacity, and the growing friendliness between Russia and the United States, I give most of that credit to Gorbachev. Someone who talks about evil empire and things like that isn't really making friends with Russians. they have to extend the hand of friendship. So I'm happy about that growing peaceful relationship and cooperation between our two states. And possibly something can come out of that. So that gives me a little hope.
Doesn't Gorbachev want to withdraw to some of his commitments, like in Africa? And I read something about
he wants
that,
to get out of his
to
many,
save money so that there will be, he'll have more money
for their own economy.
Yeah. His own economy. Yeah. Would that be some hope then that he would get the Cubans out?
Well, I think that the Angolans really don't want the Cubans there. That drains their economy. The Angolans are anxious to get rid of the Cubans. And I think the Ethiopians are anxious to get rid of them. But Castro isn't anxious to have it happen because somebody else is paying some of his bills. He'll have 70,000 people come home where he's going to have to start paying them. So all this kind of stuff works together, too.
We'll have to improve our relations with Castro in order to make part of the puzzle.
Yeah, sure, be part of the puzzle, too. But the Namibians are caught in the crossfire, yes.
I think the questions that the person here points out that we perhaps have a role to play with our own politicians.
Oh, yes.
And how about suggestions as to where we can fit into that role and how?
Well, the suggestions have been in the past, and it's been shaping up what's going to happen with that Senate bill, which includes Namibia. The bill in Congress now for economic sanctions against South Africa includes the Namibia cause. And it's been passed by the House. It's been recommended by the committee of the Senate. But there are a lot of people who think that it will never get to the floor of the Senate. So I think the only thing that we can do is to phone or write to our senators and tell them that action should be taken on that bill this year before the election. That will call for stronger sanctions against South Africa. Now, you read people like Jack Kilpatrick and Gigi Geyer and those editorial writers or those columnists say the sanctions haven't done anything. Sanctions have done a lot. It's their opinion that they haven't done anything. Why has South Africa come this far beyond the fact that body bags are going home and that they recognize that their artillery, not their artillery, but their planes are inferior to what they're fighting? I think those are major reasons. But their planes would not be inferior if sanctions were not leveled against them. And price of gold is not going up very much. And that's their main trading item. They have to find new trading partners and haven't found very many for their agricultural products. And so South Africa is hurting. And if there was some way to stop oil from flowing into South Africa, they would really be hurting after about 2 years. They've got enough oil stored, experts say, for about 2 years. But and it's about the only thing South Africa doesn't have. It's like Israel. Israel and South Africa don't have oil. And the way the economy is built these days, you need oil. They don't have much hydroelectric power either. They're converting coal into oil. They have that kind of process and technology. But oil is kind of their Achilles heel. That can be stopped. And here American companies are involved, and so it is important that sanctions bill be passed. I don't know what will happen if it has to go over until the next Congress. I guess nothing happens, huh? They have to start over again. But that's the action that I think is needed right now. Now, these sheets up here give you some of the telephone numbers that you can call. I think this one has it in. The Washington Office on Africa has a hotline which is funded by Lutheran ELCA. And that hotline, you call, you know, it's convenient for us to call there early in the morning or late at night at cheap rates. And each week they put on that hotline what kind of congressional action is needed and who to write to and the like. In Oregon, we know that Hatfield is probably on board, that we're not sure about
Packwood.
Yeah, we're not sure about Packwood, whether he would vote for those sanctions or not. So both of them, however, ought to be contacted. They have been contacted by me, but you should call every day because they don't put down names, they just put down marks for or against it. But that would be the thing. I know that it is 5 o'clock, and I don't intend to keep people, but if anyone wants to sit around and talk, pick up this literature, you're welcome to it. The last Thursday's Christian Science Monitor had a good editorial called "Is Namibia on the Peace Train?" And it was suggesting that South Africa has a lot to gain, that it's a win-win situation for South Africa. Because, and the way they write it up, it scares me because it sounds like it's not going to change anything in Namibia. That South Africa would have the power to do what it wants. But pick these things up, please, and thanks for coming. Mm-hmm.